Tara Wicker is with us, the Metro Councilwoman from East Baton Rouge Parish. And Tara, I know you, like many others, but especially you, you've been following this case since its inception. What's your take 10 months out?
You know, we were actively involved, of course, of everything that happened because of the impact that everything had on the community last year and just the unprecedented issues that we were faced with last year. And, you know, we're at the point where we're just trying to make sure that people are as prepared and ready and both mentally and emotionally. So we're having a lot of conversations with individuals about how to process whatever's going to happen on both sides. I've had opportunities to speak with members of the Alton Sterling family. I've had opportunities to speak with police officials. And you know, everybody's just wanting so badly to make sure that at the end of the day, and this is on both sides, that whatever happens, that Baton Rouge does not return to where it was last year, that there's not this big divide, that we're able to come together as a community and move forward. So I'm hopeful.
Are you confident that things will be calm?
I'm optimistic. I can't say confident because it's just an unknown. I believe that people are at a different place than they were last year, and I think that individuals are wanting to see an end to this one way or the other. That's been the sentiment that I've heard overwhelmingly from many people is, you know, let's just bring some closure to this. Whatever it is, let it happen. Let us be able to deal with it and move forward. We have not had any indications that there are, you know, individuals that are intending to, you know, be violent and things of that sort. I did hear on yesterday that presumably there may be individuals that have come into town quietly as it's kept and are waiting to see what's going to happen. And, you know, I think the way that we handle that as a community is going to determine the outcome of how we deal with situations as Baton Rougeans together, as opposed to the way that we allow other people from other communities and other cities to come in and dictate what we do here.
Based on what you saw on the video that has been readily available, what's your perception about what happened that night?
My issue is that I want to see definitely more of the information. I know that there was some footage that we did not see that was confiscated by, I guess, the police department and then the federal government as it relates to what happened prior to. There was some surveillance camera footage or some body camera footage, and I'm not sure how much of the entire story we have. I do believe that when I look at what happened on the camera and from what I was able to see, you know, I'm not an attorney, I'm not a police officer, I don't know what procedures were in place and what was not. You know, my hope was that at the end of the day, we never want to have someone's life taken. And if policies were followed and that happened, I want to know that that was according to policies and procedures and not a reaction based on emotion or fear. And I think that's really the concern in this case is, you know, were policies and procedures followed? Was there actively justification or was there an emotional response to a situation that's, you know, unknown?
What was your assessment of the district attorney recusing himself?
Well, you know, I think that in light of the fact that, you know, there were close relationships, anytime that you have those close relationships and you are not in a position of being able to make sure that you are objective and you're in a position of being able to, you know, you're that close to a situation, it kind of it clogs the opportunity for there to be a fair situation to occur. So I don't have a problem with him recusing himself. I think that in light of his close relationships and things, that because if he had not, I believe that that would have definitely come into question because someone would have known or found out about the close relationship and then we've been dealing with another issue as to, you know, why didn't you recuse yourself if you knew you were that close to that family? So I think it was wisdom for him to do that.
Should the Attorney General open an investigation if need be?
I believe that we need to make sure that at the end of the day, all things are followed to make sure that we get down to the bottom of all the details. We, as a community, people want to make sure that at the closure of this, all questions are answered. And if that means making sure that there's a further investigation that is needed to make sure that people feel comfortable, I think if there are questions that are still remaining, it's everybody's responsibility who has access and the ability to make sure that people feel like, as a community, that they have closure in this situation.
Well, as you know, immediately there were demonstrations the night of the shooting. Over 100 people gathered in the early morning hours of the Triple S Food Mart, shouting, "No justice, no peace." And then, of course, the three officers were killed by an agitator who came to town. Agitator is a kind word for Gavin Long. He obviously was mentally unstable, but the July of last year was not a good month, and tensions were on edge. There were protests. People were arrested. People were injured, both from law enforcement and from the public, the people who were there. Have we gotten past that to the point where we as a community can unite and move forward?
You know, I think right after all of that occurred, there was a lot of emotions, a lot of dialogue, and it was real interesting because, right after the shooting, you found this quiet but very obvious and visible divide in the Baton Rouge community. You know, and it started just getting more and more broader, especially after the police officers were killed, and we just saw Baton Rouge moving into a place that it did not, we didn't recognize. And so, but the interesting thing is that when the flood occurred, sort of a lot of those tensions and divisions, differences started to disappear. So we found ourselves at another very emotional, very bad place, but it was a different place. And it actually, in a sense, brought us back together. So, you know, if I had to look at a silver lining in last year, I think that, you know, we saw that we were divided. We were headed down a course that none of us were comfortable with. The flood, miraculously, as horrible as it was, brought us back together as a community. So now I think that allowed us to have a foundation to build upon. A lot of things were washed away. A lot of things were removed, and it left us with a solid foundation to rebuild Baton Rouge the way that we really wanted. Trey and I, Councilman Welch and I, saw that happening in the very beginning when there were policies on the council that just started coming up that realistically we had not had a conversation about, the community had not had a conversation about it. People were very uncomfortable. So we said, wait a minute, let's slow this process down. Let's sit among one another and have some dialogue. And so we did. We created that Police Policy Review Committee, which has been a phenomenal committee. They're about to release the policy paper from the university's academic committee. But what we found in that is sitting in that room, you had protesters, you had moms, you had dads, you had police officers, you had elected officials, policymakers. You had all kinds of individuals that came to that table and an opportunity for them to vet their emotions, how they felt, what they thought was wrong, what they thought needed to change, what they thought was right. And we've been seeing a tremendous coming together of our communities. Like I said, I don't really believe that we're in the same place that we were last year. I think we're in a better place, and I'm hopeful that whatever the decision is, that we don't lose that.
We're hearing the voice of Tara Wicker, East Baton Rouge Parish Councilwoman. Yesterday on this show, we heard from LSU Law Professor Chris Tyson, and he wrote in the New York Times this: present-day Baton Rouge is essentially two cities, one South Baton Rouge, prosperous and amenity-filled, predominantly the white, middle-class network of cul-de-sac neighborhoods, upscale shopping centers, the other North Baton Rouge, a marginalized, forgotten collection of the city's older neighborhoods and neglected infrastructure. These issues that were present before the Sterling shooting, I think it's fair to say, Councilwoman Wicker, that they were certainly showcased with this terrible tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
So what have we learned from this, if anything?
I think that, again, with the flood, things were a lot of things were washed into a different light, and all of a sudden, you know, and I'm kind of joking about it a little bit, but, you know, we didn't have traffic issues in District 10 until the flood, you know, and after the flood, all of a sudden we had traffic issues in District 10. But, you know, we found an influx of individuals that historically would have never even thought about living in the inner core of Baton Rouge in District 10. And we found that it was this weird sort of coming together of individuals where we were able to learn from one another, actually highlight some of the differences that we've had, and then go back and say, you know, we're really not that different. All of us want a good quality of life for our family, for our kids. And so we really have been able to see that. And
all right, hold tight. The Justice Department may come forward and announce its decision in the investigation of the two officers who were involved in the shooting of Alton Sterling at the Triple S Food Mart last July 5th, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org. Steve in St. Francisville asks whether this should have been a criminal investigation rather than a civil rights investigation. Tara Wicker, do you have any thoughts about that?
I think that when you look at the totality of this case and what has really gone on, you know, the investigation has to be able to really reveal, you know, what should happen in this case. When you talk about a criminal case versus civil rights case, you know, you have to be able to deal with what criminal action was actually occurred. And I don't think that we have those answers. I still believe that, you know, the unfortunate thing in all of this, and this is, I think, what really started a lot of the problems that we saw last year, is that people really just felt like almost right off the bat, they just didn't have the information. Literally, all of us are trying to make rational decisions from, you know, one portion of a video that was released from someone's cell phone. And so when you look at the totality of everything that comes into play with this case, the frustration that I heard from protesters as well as, you know, other citizens was just the lack of information. And everyone was saying, you know, where's the body camera footage? Where's the surveillance camera from the store? And I think not having that information, or that information missing, is part of the reasons why people are making judgment calls based on, you know, just a portion of all the facts.
Well, Alton Sterling had a record and was accused of pulling a gun on a man outside the store, which prompted the officers to arrive. Both officers reportedly had been previously investigated and cleared by the department for allegedly having used excessive force. Are those things relevant? What happened in the past for these people who were involved in this tragedy?
I think that when you look at law enforcement officials, and this is kind of the overwhelming conversation that we're having with the committee that we formed, is, you know, this idea and this concept of, you know, community policing and relationship policing and things of that sort. And so when you have officers, and I in no way, form, or fashion are saying that these officers are that, because I don't know all of their history. I don't know who they are and what's going on with them. But at the same time, we have an expectation that no matter what your past is, if you are a law enforcement officer on the force, that you follow those procedures. And my husband was a former state trooper, and he tells me all the time, he said, honey, he said, you know, you're always going to revert back to whatever you're trained. That's why we spend so much time in training. Ideally, you're supposed to revert back to what you're trained and what you're accustomed to doing. So I think that we do have to make sure that we have provisions in place that if our officers are actively trained in how to respond to certain situations, then that should be the expectation of citizens. That should be the expectation of others, that you respond in the way that you were trained. And so that's the question that I always had, even in this case, is, you know, what are the policies and procedures that were either met or not met as a result of what occurred? In light of the fact that Alton Sterling, you know, had a past and a history, I'm not sure how much of that information was made available when they were gone on the call, or, you know, what what even led up to them going out there.
I don't think they knew anything about it. I don't think they
yeah.
knew.
So I don't, you know, I don't necessarily think that, you know, I mean, he's out. He's a citizen and he's there. So I don't think that his past history and things that he's done in the past should have been an issue as to how they dealt with that, you know, particular situation. I think you deal with it with what's in front of you, and you allow people to, you know, you take people for face value in terms of what where they are and what they're supposed to be doing at that time.
Now, several people have commented that there were two officers. They arrived in different cars at different times, and they reacted differently to the situation. And in the end, one officer fired and the other didn't, seeing exactly the same thing. Why mm-hmm. have they been lumped together?
I think because, in my opinion, and this is power. This is not anybody else. This is just power. I think that when you're there as a coworker or as an accountability part of the process, is that you may have not been the one that pulled the trigger, but also I think that they're trying to lump him into you were there, so that makes you a part of that process, so that makes you as responsible as the guy that pulled the trigger. I'm not sure that I yield to that opinion. I think that when you have to look at the totality of the situation, you have to deal with the person that made that decision. When I looked at that film, they were in very, very close proximity to one another. You know, everybody was it was a real close situation. One was trying to hold, one was trying to move his hands and things of that sort. From what I saw, so. You know, when you looked at the gun going off, and that was the question, my God, who actually even shot the gun? It was so unclear as to even how that happened, but they were in close proximity. I don't know the policy as it relates to when you see an officer that's doing something that, you know, they believe is putting their life or somebody else's life in imminent danger. What's the protocol on that in terms of having another officer there? Do you stop? I know somebody said he has a gun. I do remember hearing that. So I don't know if it was he has a gun and then the automatic was, okay, I got my gun and I'm shooting. I don't know the answers to all of that. That's why I think the investigation is just so important, because all of us can sit back and armchair quarterback. But until you're in that situation and you have to deal with, you know, what you've been trained to do, what's going on, you really don't have a good understanding of what that's all about. And, you know, one of the things I want to just say this, that we've prided ourselves on since that incident, is that we realized with this committee we're releasing a do's and don'ts in terms of citizens and police rights, so that everybody understands in totality that when you're approached by a police officer or when you're in that situation, this is the way that you should respond. These are your rights as a citizen, and these are the rights that the police officer has. Because we found out that a whole lot of people had no clue about what that interaction should really look like. So we have to educate our public on that as well.
And it's never a good idea to not do what the police officers are telling you, unless it's some case in which obvious abuse is occurring. But when they ask you to comply, generally it's a pretty good idea to comply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I told my 14-year-old son when it all came out, because, you know, It all of a sudden, as a mom, my thought of my 14-year-old son driving around, and I had to think, you know, does he know when he gets ready to drive, does he actually know, even though his father was a police officer, does he know how to interact with a police officer when he comes to complying? And I remember grabbing his shirt, and I said, let me explain to you, son. I said, if you're stopped by an officer, you don't question, you get out. If they tell you to hold your hands up, hold your hands up. If they tell you to get on the ground, get on the ground. But you make sure that you comply, because he's the authority in that situation at that point. Anything else outside of your rights being violated, we'll deal with that in court. But you do what you're told to do when you're on that street and you get home safely. So, you know, it is a good idea just to make sure that people understand their role. And, you know, especially with now officers being shot, I know that, you know, they have families to go home to as well. And so I'm finding that we have police officers that are just as afraid of doing their job as we have citizens being stopped by police. And that's just not a good recipe at all for peace in our community.
When the announcement is made, Councilwoman Wicker, is there a plan for community leaders to come together and perhaps have a joint event as you did early on in this case?
Yes, we've been having conversations about how the protocol and what we're going to do when it does happen, when we receive the word. We are planning there is going to be presumably a press conference or some sort of community event so that people are aware. People also understand what the expectations are, you know, what we are going to do as a community and what we're not going to do. So there is a plan in place for everyone to come together and make sure that we are effectively in united, communicating with the community so that everyone will have direction.
Some have suggested designated protest areas. Would that be practical?
I think that we want to make sure, number one, that people feel comfortable with being able to protest peacefully if that's what they want to do. One of the issues that we dealt with last year was people wanting to go on the interstate and take over sort of major highways and things of that sort and impeding traffic, which, you know, is never a good idea. And so I think the idea with designated protest areas allows for there to be some order and structure. If you want to protest, this is where we're protesting, this is why we're protesting, so that we can keep people safe. If you don't, I think that you end up with some chaos and uncontrolled actions that...
Okay, we do have to roll, but thank you, Councilwoman Wicker, and we'll follow this story with you.